The census count comes to an end, and John Cicada performs in a benefit concert this weekend. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Supreme Court ruled on President Trump's call to end the census count. That could leave Florida a big loser considering the state remains significantly undercounted. Also, older voters are still the largest voting bloc. But could there be a surge of young voters this November?
It's extremely important for young people to vote not only this election, but every election.
We'll look at what is driving the youth vote. Finally, John Cicada became an international star launching his career in Miami. He joins us to discuss learning from the Estefans, rising to stardom, and a special performance this weekend for COVID-19 relief. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the clock is ticking on the time that's left for people to get counted for the 2020 census. The deadline is today, meaning that there's only just a few hours left for those who still have not yet responded to the survey. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Trump administration's request to end the count early. The census is supposed to count every living person in the U.S., and those numbers determine congressional representation and federal funding. Florida is predicted to suffer one of the highest undercounts in the nation. That's according to a report by the Urban Institute. Mike Snyder is a reporter with the Associated Press. He's been looking into the latest on the census in Florida, and he joins us now. Mike, great to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the Trump administration has been pushing for an early end to the census in order to meet this end of the year deadline. Why is the deadline important?
Well, the deadline is important because that's when the Census Bureau has to turn in numbers that are used to decide how many congressional seats each state gets. And this is important for the Trump administration because the president wants to exclude people who are in the country illegally from that count that is used for what's called apportionment. And in order for them to be able to do that, they would have to turn in the numbers by this congressionally mandated deadline that is December 31st. It would be under the control of the Trump administration, no matter who wins the election next month.
Can the Census Bureau provide an accurate count, provide accurate information and meet the deadline?
That's a very good question. The Census Bureau had originally requested, well, first of all, they changed, the deadlines have been constantly moving, and that's because of the pandemic. The Census Bureau was originally planning for the 2020 census to end at the end of July. Then the pandemic came, they were forced to stop some field operations, so they pushed that deadline back to October 31st, and they made a request in Congress to turn in the apportionment numbers, the numbers used to determine how many congressional seats each state gets. They just asked to push that back till April. So President Trump says he wants to exclude people in the country illegally from being used in the apportionment count, and the Census Bureau switched the deadline back to September. It's been litigated over the past couple of weeks, and this week the Supreme Court said the count can end this week. People believe that, there's still people left to be counted that could have been counted in the next 2 weeks between now and October 31st. And then there's a greater concern right now with whether the Census Bureau is going to be able to crunch all the numbers accurately between now and December 31st. They had originally given themselves 5 to 6 months to crunch these numbers, and now they have less than 3 months to do that. And it's a very time-consuming and tedious process. They have to eliminate duplicate answers. They have to use administrative records to kind of fill in the information gap for households. They don't have much information, and it takes time. And they have a lot of different checks for quality that are likely going to be eliminated if they try to meet this December 31st deadline.
And as always, as we've been talking about on this program, on this station for a while, how important is the census? Is the fact that knowing the count, especially in different communities, will determine congressional seats. You could win some, you could lose some, and of course, federal funding. What do we know about the response rate so far for the state of Florida, but also for South Florida?
Right. Well, you know, the response rate for the state of Florida was below the national average. And I think as far as the self-response rate, Florida ranked number 33. So, you know, if you were to grade Florida, it'd probably be about a C minus they'd get on their report card. But there are two ways that the Census Bureau gathers the information about households. One is through self-response, which Florida, you know, did below average. And the other is when census takers go out and knock on the homes of households that haven't yet responded. So if you add those two parts together, the Census Bureau says Florida's completion rate is now 99.9%. But, you know, self-response is always a lot better. It's always going to be more accurate than census takers getting the information, because the census takers often aren't able to interview the people in the household. So then they'll interview a next door neighbor or a landlord, or they'll use administrative records to fill in that gap. And, you know, sometimes the information they get that way isn't accurate.
And last summer, the Trump administration fought to include the question asking people about their citizenship status, and the Supreme Court blocked the question. But did that effort perhaps have an impact on non-citizens?
I think people who were challenging putting the citizenship question on the census form say it does. It did have an impact. And what also had an impact was the fact that the Trump administration brought that same issue back this past July, when President Trump issued this directive to the Census Bureau to exclude undocumented people from the apportionment count. And there have been lawsuits over that. And in the lawsuits, the people who are suing, which are local governments and advocacy groups, say this has had a chilling effect. You know, this latest order from the Trump administration is causing people in the country illegally to question whether they should participate or not. So between trying to add a citizenship question and then this latest order from July, it probably has had some effect on the participation.
And I mean, look, Florida's population's been growing over the past decade. But look, I mean, if we're not getting an accurate count and we're this low, is there any risk of losing congressional seats when you would think that we would gain them?
Right, exactly. Well, Florida isn't going to risk losing a seat, but it might not get as many new seats as it had hoped. The estimates have been that Florida was going to gain 1 to 2 seats. So if all the people who have moved here to Florida in the past decade aren't counted, Florida could lose out on getting that second extra seat. Instead of getting 2 seats, they might just get 1 seat.
Do we have any idea where those seats would have been expected?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, Central Florida, I think, has been probably one of the fastest growing parts of the state. I would imagine it might be Central Florida or maybe somewhere in Southwest Florida. That's purely speculation on my part. But, you know, if you look, and you could also look to the 2010 census, when I guess the growth really was in Central Florida and then also South Florida.
Yeah. And of course, Central Florida, the I-4 corridor. The census is supposed to count every person living in the U.S., nothing to do with citizenship, every person. Can that happen by the deadline, which is, again, today?
Right. You have people who have been working on it for years to make sure people get counted where they live. And they are very concerned that millions of people are not going to be counted because of the shortened deadline by 2 weeks, but also because the deadline has moved around so much that it has confused people who think they might have a little time to fill out the census form and then realize that today's the deadline. But interestingly enough, the deadline is for 11:59 p.m. Hawaiian time. So with the time difference, people on the East Coast have up until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning to fill out the census form.
I'm talking with Mike Schneider, reporter with the Associated Press. He's been looking into the latest on the census in Florida. The deadline to be counted is today, after the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Trump administration's request to end the count early. Again, the count ends today. you can go online and self-count. So, you know, we'll have that information for you on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so we heard from different people. We heard from Paul in Boca Raton on the Florida Roundup a few weeks ago about this.
Earlier in the year, I was offered a position with the Census Bureau as an enumerator, which is the first the people that go knocking on doors after the mail-in responses aren't sent in. But however, between the time I made the application and was offered the position, and then when they did, I think it was in August maybe, they called me and they asked me if I was ready, and I said absolutely not. I would not be comfortable knocking on people's doors at this time. So it's unfortunate. I'm sure that there were many people like me possibly that had to turn the position down.
So, Mike, how's the pandemic, you know, impacted the census count this time around?
Well, what Paul said is exactly right. First of all, it made getting census takers really difficult. The Census Bureau says that I think more than a third of the workers they had hired and then trained ultimately would not show up for the first assignment. So that was very problematic. Then also just the constantly changing schedule has really impacted the count because of the pandemic and the fact that, you know, people originally thought it was supposed to end in July and then it was going to end in October and then it was going to end in September and then it was going to end in October again. That has really played, you know, has been very problematic. You know, even though the Census Bureau's, the census takers, they had a lot of dropouts. The Census Bureau says that they've been managed to overcome that because the workers who actually did show up have been more productive. And the Census Bureau has offered incentives for workers who stuck around.
Yeah, well, I wondered what the compensation was for census workers and if that wasn't part of the problem.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty good pay. Depending on where you are in the country, the hourly wage was $15 to $30 an hour. And then with the incentives, it's even more than that. So the Census Bureau, the pay was pretty well. But, you know, that didn't stop census takers or actually the pandemic stopped census takers from, you know, going to work, even though the pay was so well.
That's double Florida's minimum wage, more than double in some cases. You know, going back to the ground game, I mean, like how going out door to door to try to get that accurate count. Again, what we heard from Paul, did you see a lot of that? A lot of people who just were too scared and they said, that's it, I can't do this.
Yeah, they really did. The Census Bureau provided masks and hand sanitizers and told people to socially distance and to not go inside if they're invited inside to someone's home. You know, the pandemic and the chance of catching the virus has scared off a lot of census takers. And there are also fears that it prevented people from answering their doors if a stranger came wanting to ask them questions. So, you know, it might have affected the participation of some households because of that.
All right. So, again, the deadlines today remind people, how could they do this? How long does it take?
Well, it's very easy if they have computer access. The best way is to go to online to the website 2020census.gov, and they can fill out the form. It takes less than 10 minutes. It's pretty easy. On the East Coast in Florida, the Census Bureau will be accepting answers up until shortly before 6 a.m. tomorrow morning because they're ending at 11:59 p.m. Hawaiian time.
All right, so there's still a little bit of time, and again, as Mike said, it just takes about 10 minutes, really barely that, so not that much time. If you have the opportunity, we will share that website again on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Mike Schneider, reporter with the Associated Press. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, are young voters apathetic? A look at how turnout could be much different this November. And by the way, you're listening to Grammy winner John Sicata from Miami. Our conversation with him later in the hour. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Both presidential candidates are in South Florida today for campaign events ahead of the November election. Both campaigns have done significant outreach to senior voters. But what about the youth vote? In 2016, only 50% of voters aged 18 to 29 participated in the general election. That's according to research from the Brookings Institution. But this year may be different. Over the past year, students at FIU, led by Associate Professor of Journalism Daniel Evans, have been reaching out to more than 100 young voters in Wisconsin and in Florida, like Trinity Tressner, a sophomore at Valencia College in Orlando.
I believe that it's extremely important for young people to vote not only this election, but every election. Young people make up a good portion of the vote, so it's really, really important that I'm involving myself and doing everything I can, ensure that everybody else is, registered and aware of the importance of this election and all elections.
Daniel Evans joins us now via Skype. He's also the Miami Bureau Chief of South Florida Media Network. Daniel, great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Absolutely. And also joining us is Selena Stanley, a senior at FIU interested in investigative journalism. She was part of the Young Voters Project. Selena, great to have you as well.
Appreciate it.
Daniel, I want to start with you. What questions were you hoping to answer when you started this project looking at young voters?
Well, there was a lot of interest, obviously, in young voters in the presidential election. And in Florida, the rate of young voters has been on a continual upswing since 2012. It's still pretty low, however. The reason that we looked at Florida versus Wisconsin is Wisconsin young voters actually turn out at a much higher rate than anywhere else in the nation. And while Florida is increasing amongst that subset, we're still ranked pretty much 40th in the nation. So what we were trying to do was to see if there was any, what the differences were within the voters in that age group, to see if anything that was being done in Wisconsin could actually be transferred down south.
And you wanted to travel throughout Wisconsin and Florida, to talk to young voters, but then the pandemic hit.
Yeah, that's right. That really wasn't in the cards. Wisconsin actually is looking, their COVID-19 positivity rates are very close to what we were, kind of in the middle of our surge. So they're not looking real good right now. So what I did was I pivoted to look to do more of a deep dive in the statistical analysis, which was quite a project in and of itself.
Actually. Yeah. So, what would you say, jumped out at you about young voters in Wisconsin and Florida going into this election? What really, surprised you?
Well, actually, before I forget, I want to make sure that I send a shout out to my colleague, Neil Reisner, whose students actually also participated. But to answer your question, what we found was that younger voters in Florida are much more, those who are supporting Biden are much more soft in their support. That is, we hear a lot of the lesser of two evils. I'm holding my nose and voting for him. I just don't want to see Trump reelected. Where the Trump voters in both states, both in Florida and Wisconsin, are much more excited to vote for Trump. This is actually in line. There was a Harvard University study that showed that is pretty much the case in that age group and amongst many age groups, as it turns out.
Yeah. Now, you spoke again with students, over 100 voters in Florida and Wisconsin. Here's one of them. This is Mark Orlowski. It's a student at the University of Wisconsin, Whitewater, who will be casting his first ever presidential vote this year.
My family has voted in every election since my parents were 18. So I'm supporting Joe Biden. It's partly out of I believe Trump is a true danger to this country. But I think there are some real policies with Biden, such as being carbon emission free by 2050, that would be very beneficial to our nation's future. We have a guy out here, Don Ruwink, who definitely cares about young people. Generally, I'd say no, just because we don't vote, so you don't need to win our votes. But between the two, absolutely, Joe Biden would be better for young people.
Selena, what was it like hearing from college students in Wisconsin? How did it make you think about young voters differently?
One thing I really learned while doing this project is that for a lot of young people, it's not that they don't care a lot of them really feel like the politicians of today aren't there to serve them, because some of the things they really care about, like affordable education or climate change, are often overlooked by politicians, and especially with the candidates we have in this upcoming election.
And I wondered, you know, Selena, how many of the folks you spoke with had conviction about who they were going to vote for compared to those who were undecided, they didn't really know?
I spoke to 4 students, and none of them were actually very excited to vote. And the ones who supported Biden were very, they had a soft conviction, and then the ones who were undecided were just completely clueless. So, you know, that was interesting to see.
You know, there's an assumption that young voters are this monolithic voting block, and that they usually all vote Democratic, and that's not necessarily the case. Let's listen to another student. This is John Beauchamp, also from Wisconsin.
President Trump has shown some tremendous leadership, and I think that's something that Joe Biden just cannot offer. President Trump has done more for young people than Joe Biden says he will do or really ever has done. Specifically, one point I can definitely relate to is his action on free speech on college campus. He's done a great deal with that in ensuring that campuses who are oppressing any students' views are going to be punished in some form.
Daniel, how do the politics of young voters differ in the two states, depending on socioeconomic status, education? I mean, what did you see along the lines?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, when I talked to a number of political scientists in both Florida and Wisconsin, there was a, you know, the kind of feeling that they had about young voters and the differences in the turnout between the two has a lot to do with, you know, 3 main measures. The younger population in Wisconsin is generally better educated and better off, has a higher amount of money, basically. And both of those things, from studies that they talked to me about, are directly correlated to higher turnout. Basically, if you are younger, you're not in college, you're working, you're struggling to make ends meet, you are simply not voting is simply not a priority. The other thing that directly affects turnout is the relatively or actually very high amount of time between the end of the registration deadline in Florida and Election Day. We're one of the longest gaps between the two. In Wisconsin, you can actually register and vote on the same day. You can register on Election Day in Wisconsin. You can't do that here. And the professor I spoke to in Wisconsin said that he believes that that increases the turnout up to 6 to 7% overall, and it's particularly weighted to groups that have lower turnout, that traditionally have lower turnout, that is, you know, younger voters.
That is an interesting point to bring up again, that in Florida you have to there's a deadline to register before there is a deadline to vote. In Wisconsin, that registration, you could register the day of the vote. Again, I'm talking with Daniel Evans, associate professor of journalism at FIU. Also with us is Selena Stanley, a journalism student at FIU. And the students, along with Professor Evans, spent a year, again, speaking with young voters in Wisconsin and Florida, trying to get an idea of the young vote and how much will they be participating in this upcoming election. By the way, you can find us on social media, Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. And we'd love to hear from you. If you're part of that young group, how do you feel about this upcoming election? Are you excited? Will you be participating? Daniel, one of the other problems, or well, looking at this, the other problem isn't about participation. It's about votes not getting counted. I thought this was interesting. What are some of the issues that came up in terms of familiarity with vote by mail and issues with signatures?
Yeah, so those were actually a couple really interesting issues. So it turns out that younger people have their votes rejected at a rate three times as much as people over 65 who have the lowest rejection rate. Now, there's a couple reasons from this, from the experts that I spoke to, and one of them is that young people tend to move a lot. They move a lot more than people in other age groups. And if they decided to vote by mail, the U.S. Postal Service won't forward a mail ballot. And so they may have disenfranchised themselves that way. Another thing, and this is something that a the professor, a political science professor, the chair of the journalism, political science department at UF said about the signatures is that often the signature that's on file might have been the one that these young people filled out when they were in high school civics class. And as he put it rather memorably, they might still have be putting a heart over the eye. And that's just not how they've decided to sign their name once they get into college.
Right.
And so it gets thrown out because it doesn't match.
That in of itself right there is fascinating because I remember being a teenager, you get cute. I never put a heart over my eye, but I knew people who did. And this is one of the challenges, again, in matching signatures. Selena, you've heard the trope that young voters are apathetic. They don't show up to vote because they're disinterested. But based on the conversations you had with young voters in Wisconsin and Florida, are you finding that that's true? Or is there a greater level of interest in this year's election?
So I did have my own assumptions going into this project as well, because I am the only one in my friend group interested in politics. But I was actually pleasantly surprised with a lot of the people that I interviewed, because several of them were interested in this election because the issues going on right now directly affect them. They're all struggling because of the pandemic with either virtual learning or going to school safely. A lot of them have lost their jobs. And at this point, I think most people know someone who's been affected by the coronavirus. And I also interviewed one student who said she really resonated with the Black Lives Matter movement. So I think a lot of young people do want to see change. They just are not really sure how to do that, whether it's to vote or get involved in other ways.
And did you hear anybody talk about, this being their first presidential election that they could vote in? Was that important to them? Were they excited about that?
Yes, I did speak to a lot of first-time voters, and they weren't particularly excited at the candidates they could choose from, but they were excited to be a part of this for the first time.
So, Dan, I'm wondering, again, something you mentioned before is that you saw a difference in socioeconomic status and, of course, education levels, but I'm trying to figure out, what would solve this problem? I mean, could it be greater civics education in high school? Would that help in voter interest? I mean, was there any data that told you what that solution might be?
Honestly, the idea that increasing the education and poverty and affluence rates in the state is kind of a long-term problem. And again, I just want to make sure I'm clear. I'm talking about the education and wealth rates of that young subset, not the state as a whole.
Right.
Because as it turns out, that's not necessarily the case that in other economic stratas. But in terms of that is a long-term solution. I do believe that better civics education is important. I don't really have any data that shows that there's a direct correlation with that, though.
Yeah.
It does seem the thing that would have the most direct response is making it easier to vote. The long delay between the registration deadline and election day particularly impacts younger voters because they tend to do things more last minute. Now, this is probably something that is probably not going to change until they get older. It's just a fact of life throughout the country.
Yeah.
So that would make it easier. If you made it easier to vote, you would have more turnout. And that takes political will. And obviously, that's a political argument, but yeah. That's the most obvious.
And Selena, I'm wondering if you have these conversations with your peers as we're coming up on this election. Talking about going out and voting. How often do you have those conversations, and how often do you get any pushback?
I talk about voting with my friends pretty often, but I have noticed that in this year. It is going to be harder for a lot of students to vote because most of them voted on their college campuses in the last election, and now they're not necessarily comfortable to do that. So I have been posting on social media, telling people to register and sign up to get a mail-in ballot. But, you know, it's all up to the individual, and there's only so much that those pushes and those advertisements can do.
Yeah. Again, talking about the youth vote, how involved will youth be in this upcoming election? I've been talking with Selena Stanley, a journalism student at FIU, and Daniel Evans, associate professor of journalism at FIU, and you can learn more about their research on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Daniel, Selena, thank you so much for the insight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, the election, less than 3 weeks away. Well, still to come, Grammy winner John Secada is part of a special COVID benefit concert this weekend, and he joins us coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're hearing Just Another Day, one of the many hits from Cuban-American singer John Secada. He's going to be performing this Saturday at 8 p.m. as part of the Jazz Aid Live from the Banyan Bowl. It's part of an 8-concert series that will be live-streamed to raise money for the World Central Kitchen. That organization, led by Chef Jose Andres, is focused on feeding families impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. And he joins us now. John Secada, it's such a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Luis. Thank you for having me.
I want to talk about this concert, and I was thinking about what life is like in this pandemic. But I got to start with where it all started for you. And I was curious about your upbringing. I mean, you were born in Havana in 1961. In those first 10 years you were there before you came to Miami, what was your musical influence?
I really didn't tap into anything dealing with music till I came to the States. Really, my inclination to kind of and my passion towards music started when we came to Miami. Being raised in Hialeah, and I was just initially I was so enamored with American music. I was enamored with R&B, with rock, with pop, and those were the things that I was really, really into. That was my magnet in terms of what I really enjoyed. And but of course, I love Latin music, Spanish music as well. This community and my traditions and my culture is a part of who I am as well. But initially, my music. And what it really inspired me in the music that came to be, that really got me the career that I have, it started with those kind of influences, the R&B, the pop, the rock, everything that I would listen to in the radio, basically, from the time that I came to the States.
Yeah, you arrived, was it like 1971, you arrived in Miami, you grew up in Hialeah. I wondered if did you have this, because I think about like when I got to this country, and I was more enamored with American music than I was anything from back home.
Right, right.
is that what it was for you?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that music, the entertainment in general, music being a part of that, it helped me to overcome the culture barrier for me being Afro-Cuban American and learning the language. it helped a lot because all I would do, I was so, I wanted to be engaged with American entertainment so much, and at the same time, I wanted to learn the language, and I wanted to integrate as much as of myself as I could into this brand new country for me, and music was a bridge towards that. Entertainment in general.
Yeah. When did you start noticing, though, like, you have a talent for it? Was it you, or was it somebody said, hey, you got a talent here. There's something you should develop.
Yeah, I always knew that I could sing. Maybe I had a feeling that I could maybe sing since I guess I was 8, 9 years old, maybe 10. As soon as I came to the States, I kind of had a feeling that maybe that's something that I could explore. I never did anything about it till high school, though. That's when I really kind of took the leap of faith to walk in into the music department one day, and I guess I needed affirmation. I needed somebody to say, well, maybe you can. And the music teacher, when she heard me sing, and there were. Had me sing something, and then she said, "Wow, wait a minute! You know, you by the way, you can sing, you know, you can sing, Juan, and you can do that." And but yeah, that's when it started for me. It was my second year in high school.
And then you went to the Frost School of Music.
Yes, I did, and that was a big decision for me. I obviously I once I really got into music in high school, that passion and fever towards what I guess what became my career, that's it started in high school, but I felt that education was something that could be important for me, and I was inspired by my high school music teacher, so I applied to the University of Miami, the Frost School of Music, and I got in, and at first I was a music education major. And eventually I got more into performance and jazz music. And, but yes, my education has been pivotal in everything that I've done, from as a songwriter, as a musician, of course, and the way that I, communicate with other musicians and other artists, and then my productions, opportunities that I've had working with different people in the studio. It all started because of going to school there.
And then, of course, like anything, you know, you meet people in your life and that can change the path of your life. And you got to meet Emilio Estefan, and that really turned everything for you.
Yeah, that was definitely the page turner. And I met Emilio through the guys that I work with in a band here in Miami that I went to college with. And so that was another pivotal moment in my life, just the opportunity to go ahead and through colleagues of mine to eventually to get that opportunity to meet Emilio, and of course, and that changed everything, and we worked together for 18 years, and we're still very close. We're still very close. I'm very close still with him and with Gloria. I mean, they're godparents to my son, and so that was it. That was the beginning of everything that came to be for me.
Again, I'm talking with Grammy winner John Secada. He's going to be performing this Saturday as part of the Jazz Aid Live from the Banyan Bowl. It's an 8-concert series that'll be live stream, and it's to raise money for the World Central Kitchen. That's the organization led by Chef Jose Andres, focused on feeding families impacted by this pandemic. And you can learn more about that series on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So I remember, John, I think, I was into college, and your album comes out, John Secada, 1992, and it was all over the radio all the time. I will also say, by the way, that, you know, helped me out on a lot of dates, too, the romantic ballad. So I owe you a lot for that. But, you know, I'm wondering, like, all of a sudden, you're an international star, and I wondered what that was like for you, and did Emilio teach you anything about how to handle that?
I was very fortunate. My record deal and the record company, when I first was signed, they thought that the project, what the music that I had to offer, that it could have an international type of appeal. And I was obviously elated, because then there was this kind of commitment by different territories of the record company, of EMI, that wanted to go ahead and promote my record. And I guess I was a little bit prepared for it, because I had already been traveling with Gloria. There was a tour that she did it in 1990, 1991, that I was a part of with her. So I got a taste of what it was to travel and to meet different people and different executives and different people from all over the world. So that was kind of like, I guess, my introduction. And then when my career started and I started to travel, then of course it was a learning experience as I went along. But I guess I already had that connection because of the tour of Gloria. It was a blessing. Just the fact that it was immediately, I got the opportunity to travel everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, from Europe to Asia to Latin America. I mean, it was amazing.
John Secada, the album, again, in 1992, four songs off that went top 40. The other thing, too, is this. I mean, you know, you came in the 90s. There was this surge of Latin stars, Enrique Iglesias, Ricky Martin, Selena, so many. And of course, Gloria, even though she really launched in the 80s. But what was going on in the U.S. at that time that there was this draw towards the Latin beats and rhythms?
Oh, you know, it was an amazing time to be a crossover artist, and in the early 90s, of course, I was a pivotal artist, a part of that process. But of course, you know, before that, like you said, Gloria Estefan did it in the 80s, and Julio Iglesias already was tapping into that, and Santana had been doing it for a long time, Feliciano. But the 90s was a very interesting time, because it almost felt like a new generation of artists just dipping into this whole thing of crossing over from Spanish to English. And I guess the audience was prepared for it, you know, and generationally, I think starting in this country and internationally, just the connection and the attraction to Latin rhythms and the Spanish and the language itself, and it was something that, I guess, it was an unstoppable type of connection that, you know, to this day is still going strong. And so I was very proud to be a part of that wave of artists that really was an amazing group of colleagues during the 90s.
And I wondered the role Miami played in all that, because, you know, many of you launched your careers here in Miami. What was the role the city played in developing you?
It's Miami is a special city, always has been. And during that time and prior to the 90s, it's such a cosmopolitan, multicultural city. I mean, I love that about our city. I love the fact that it's just it's a first port of entry for so many people from all over the world, and that they love the city and have made it their second home or first home, and that kind of cultural mix is, I think, that's kind of what created the how simple it was for everybody to come here, to work here, and to feel comfortable here, from all over the world, or Latin artists especially. And I love that. I love the fact that our city has always been like that. And that blend, that's what people love. They love to be attached to that fusion and that melting pot of all these different flavors, musically and otherwise.
Yeah. Let's talk about this Jazz Aid Live from the Banyan Bowl. Again, as I mentioned, a series of performances, you know, over a span of weeks. But of course, because of the pandemic, people are going to have to watch it from home. And I'm wondering, for you as a performer, I mean, what's it like? You're used to being in front of an audience and feeling that energy, and you don't have that.
Yeah, it's going to be a first for me. it will be interesting. But that's what that's what I do. I'm an entertainer at heart, and I'm going to give it my all, just as if there were people in the audience. And of course, my audience is going to be everybody that will be watching and that they're in their homes. But But that's what it's all about. And you know what? We are living just times that we've never thought we would. And I've been thinking about that and how to deal with the fact that on Saturday, how to project that, how to project the fact that, you know, the fact that we're all connected on because of one situation. And then, of course, as an entertainer, I want to give it my all based on the fact that that's what I want to do. And even though the atmosphere and the conditions are different, still what I do is not going to change.
Yeah. And for you, I'm wondering how important is it for you to be part of this performance and supporting, the COVID-19 relief efforts?
Yeah. You know, this I'm a product of this community. Everything that I've done in my career, also personally, is just because of living in South Florida. And I it's anytime that I get the chance to, especially to perform attached to any type of relief effort, I'm there. I'm always there. And if I can do it, I'm there. And so this will be a very special performance because of that.
You know, like I said, you've had this incredible career all these years, and you talked about earlier, you know, the influence Miami had on you, and again, coming in the 90s with all of these other big Latin stars. But then you look at Miami's still doing this. Miami's still churning out the DJ Khaled, Pitbull, Kali Uchis. I mean, how do you see their work, and do you see some of your own work in theirs?
I'm proud. I'm proud of all these new artists, and to see the evolution, and generationally to see how Miami is still, it's that melting pot is still creating so many great artists, so much music, and it's real and it's genuine, and it's great. I love it. I mean, I am proud that I was, almost close to 30 years ago that I was a part of it, and to see it evolve and move on and keep the fusion of all these elements to keep kind of churning and becoming new styles of music and artists blending things in from the past and making it their own. And that's what I did too.
And you still, because you collaborate with a lot, you've been doing this your whole career. You collaborate with a lot of people, the new artists today. You had a collaboration with Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, amazing. I had so many great opportunities at the beginning of my career between Sinatra and Pavarotti those opportunities were tremendous blessings, and I've internationally I've worked with so many great artists, and the opportunity to work with Gloria Estefan herself and the way that she helped me to kind of start my career, and it's been I've been very, very fortunate, Louis. I can't complain.
You know, the other thing I wondered too is, what have you seen over the years in how the American audience has embraced that Latin beat, has embraced the Latin culture because of what you people like you did?
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I mean, I think that when it happens, what I like about it is just it's happened slowly and it's happened organically, very. And again, I use the word again, very genuinely. It's just happened. People have realized how much they enjoy Latin rhythms, how much they enjoy the fusion of Latin rhythms with others, with all different styles of music, whether it's pop, rock, or dance, and R&B. And so, and the fact that it's generationally is become a natural thing for people to enjoy and to see it in other parts of entertainment, to see it in advertisements, to see it in movies and see it in TV shows. Just that fusion, that connection to the Latin flavor and the language and that's great to see, because it's happened organically and it's wonderful, and it's in the same way that hopefully all the different problems that exist with civil rights in this country, so that hopefully we can with generation that we can keep enjoying that process of acceptance acceptance, which I think is really the key word, you know,
Yeah.
with the Latin movement.
Because if there's one really good way to understand any group of people, just music. Music always brings us together,
Yes,
definitely.
absolutely, absolutely.
He is Grammy Award-winning singer based here in Miami, John Secada. Again, his performance at the Banyan Bowl in Pinecrest Gardens Saturday night. It's only an online show. It supports the World Central Kitchen and their COVID-19 relief efforts. If you want to learn more about how to watch the show, go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. John Secada, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis. My pleasure. See you out there.
All right, definitely. And that is our program for this Thursday, October 15th. Coming up next week on the show, we have a live debate with the two candidates for Miami-Dade County Mayor, Commissioners Esteban Bovo and Commissioners Daniela Levine Cava. They're going to discuss the county's response to COVID-19 and, of course, their approach to the environment, social justice issues, and we're going to take your questions. You can email them now, sundial@wlrnnews.org. And don't forget, we've got our book club. We are reading In the Land of Good Living, Journey to the Heart of Florida by Kent Russell. The story chronicles Kent's journey with his two friends walking the entire state of Florida, following the footsteps of walking Lawton Childs almost 50 years ago. Join the Sundial Book Club. Just search Sundial Book Club on Facebook, and we're going to have a chat with him coming up next week. Thanks, as always, for listening. And again, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know what you think of the program. We are a podcast as well, so look it up. I'm Luis Hernandez. Be safe. Be good to each other. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you again live on Monday.